Welcome to each and every one of you amazing Parkinson's Recovery members, and thank you so much here at the outset for your contribution. Your payments every month of $10 help to subsidize the many free services that we offer through Parkinson's Recovery here in Olympia, Washington. I have a question that was submitted that I want to read and respond to. I have a quite fascinating research report that I want to make sure to convey. We're going to then connect in with each of you who called in and find out what's up. And, of course, remember there's the chat room area here on our page that you can write anything that you'd like. If you have questions about any therapies whatsoever, then just type that in there, or any other questions. We'll read them and see if we can't provide some kind of spontaneous response to whatever your concern or topic or question might be. First of all, let me read the question. Hi, Robert. I'd be interested in hearing your opinion on NAC as a supplement to treat Parkinson's symptoms. Supposedly, it helps create dopamine in the brain. NAC is a supplement, N-acetyl carnosine, and it has a number of positive potential impacts on the body. Most of them are specifically connected to the facilitation of the production of glutathione. As I think most of you are aware, people who currently experience Parkinson's symptoms tend to be pretty severely deficient in glutathione. So the NAC supplement, it's a basic antioxidant, and there are lots of antioxidants, but this one in particular is essential for facilitating the production of glutathione in the body naturally. It can help with detox, which of course is going to be a benefit in itself. It can prevent or at least diminish liver challenges and even kidney damage. It's possible that it might have some impact on improving addictive behavior. It helps relieve challenges with respiratory conditions. If then you have some difficulty with your breathing apparatus, then this might be something you want to sort to the top of your list for consideration. And, of course, it's going to, or at least designed to, boost brain health. And that's because, again, it's because it regulates glutamate. And so it's got a lot of health benefits. It may help with mood, in other words, shifting rather depressive mood into one that's more positive. It may facilitate better sleep. It may help address infections. It may reduce inflammation. And again, as one of the many basic antioxidants, anti-inflammatories, it's got some wonderful potential beneficial impacts. I decided, well, let me just check and see if I look back at the list of the many different therapies that were reported to have been helpful to members of my audience in my last questionnaire, which was about 4 months ago. I all of a sudden wondered, I wonder if anybody specifically mentioned NAC as a supplement. Now, we had a number of reports where a person would just say supplements, and they were not specific. And, of course, that makes sense. They're taking supplements, they're feeling better, they don't know which one might have provided a beneficial outcome. There was, however, I want to report one individual who did report that they found NAC was a beneficial supplement, which is pretty amazing. So we do know and have some evidence that at least it has been reported to have been beneficial to one person. Now, the other possible approach is one that you may very well be very familiar with, and that is that there was a recent research discovery by a Eastern European researcher who has discovered that there's an enzyme in the digestive system, ME3, that facilitates the production of glutathione naturally. So ME3 is a bit of a complement to NAC. I'd be most interested if any of you are called out to do both of those, if in fact it might be that taking the NAC would boost the production of glutathione if a person was actually also using the ME3. And also, as just a heads up for everyone, I decided that what would benefit my global audience the most would be for me to create a membership website interface at a, you know, very affordable level, although I must say at the outset here that it cost quite a bit for me to actually get this service. And the idea is that for all of the many, many, many dozens of therapies that have been reported to be helpful, I am then on this membership website documenting each of these. Every week there's a new particular therapy, and what I'm doing is I'm putting up all the information that I've been able to gather over the last decade and a half. So I've got interviews, I've got research reports, I've got evidence, I've got reports from people who are telling us that it's helped. So this way, instead of my really being available to only teach perhaps once or at most twice a year to introduce these kind of therapies, and the course that I just actually introduced is called What Really Matters, I decided, well, let me start putting them up on the member website so people who all of a sudden want to get that information, they'll be able to begin to get access if they get in there. So because you're a member, I just want you to know that through the end of the month, I really wanted to set up easy access for you. So I've got a coupon code for you to use if you want to connect in there. And there's a 7-day free access, so you can see what it is and what I'm doing there and see if that's going to make a difference. Now, of course, the idea here is that if you're on the search for therapies that you are looking to see if they can facilitate a reversal of symptoms, then this would be an excellent opportunity for you to see the many, many dozens so that you can find which ones are going to call out to you. If you've already found a combination of therapies that are useful, then, of course, this is not going to be something that would probably be that useful. So the membership program is What Really Matters, and the website address, to get a really short and sweet story about the content in that new membership program, yeah, the address is, of course, www.parkinsonsrecovery.org. R-G, not .com, but rather .org for org. So the website address for this new program is the same as the name here, parkinsonsrecovery.org, and there's a link here on the support group page if you'd like to be able to investigate that further. I want to now make sure that I cover for everybody a very recent research discovery that I think is one of the most interesting and I think potentially valuable discoveries that I've seen in the last 10 years. This particular study was done by researchers at Helsinki University Hospital in Finland. They do excellent research work there. The finding is that higher exposure to commonly used oral antibiotics is linked to an increased risk of Parkinson's disease. And there is even a more refined discovery is that apparently this association is found for, in particular, broad-spectrum antibiotics and those that act against the bacteria and fungi. I know of the many thousands of people that I've talked with over the years that many people will tell me that, yeah, they had a very serious infection about 15 years ago and they took a lot of antibiotics, but, you know, they've been able to obviously recover from that successfully. Well, this study would suggest that even 10 or 15 years ago, if you've had a lot of antibiotics, what's happened is your digestive system has been totally upset, and that, as it turns out in this research study, is a predictor of the symptoms of Parkinson's. Now, this is really something that piggybacks on the findings of quite a few recent studies that indicate that the true origin of Parkinson's really isn't in the brain. It's not in the lungs. It turns out to be in the gut, in the microbial ecosystem, which means that the many, many, many healthy bacteria that are needed for digestion are simply not in your gut. So as we know, many people who experience neurological challenges have constipation. They have difficulty with their digestion system. Well, what I would like to suggest is the focus of your attention then, according to this study, would suggest get really serious about supporting the ability of your digestive system to literally come back into full and complete balance. And, of course, you can do that using lots of different approaches. One of them is being very careful about the foods you eat. And, of course, another is the probiotic interventions. The probiotics that are really excellent and perhaps the gold standard are the ones that are called Dr. O'Hara probiotics. So we do know that this is consistent with considerable research that shows that the pathologies of Parkinson's symptoms really originates in the gut, and it is associated with these microbial changes. And again, as it turns out, part of the challenge is that it may be that these antibiotics wind up really eliminating the need in the digestive system to have these healthy bacteria. Now, I want to say also, you might think, well, okay, this is one study, there are lots of studies, you know, how much credibility should I lend to this study? And I just want to say it's about a 20-year study. They examined 14,000 Parkinson's disease patients. They had a comparison group of 41,000 individuals that were not infected with Parkinson's symptoms. And then they collected some information about the antibiotic exposure over three different periods, the first 5 years, the next 5 years, and then the third 5 years. So they really, design of this is really quite magnificent. And, of course, the findings, I think, have significant impact for where I would recommend that you consider lending your direct attention about what you need to do in order to be able to get sustained relief from symptoms. So a lot of people, I think, feel like, yeah, I've had constipation for quite a while, but, you know, I've got all these Parkinson's symptoms, so I need to really focus on these supplements or these medications that address the difficulty with, in some cases, so with dopamine. And it may be that, well, yeah, that might very well be helpful, but in the long run, the real attention needs to be devoted to the issues with your gut and the problems and the issues associated with difficulties with not having the right bacteria in your gut and having a digestive system that, again, is compromised. So I have to say this is a bit of a surprise because I just assumed that if a person had taken a big, long regimen of antibiotics 15 years ago, that certainly there would have been sufficient time for an individual to be able to build back that good bacteria in their gut. This study suggests that that's likely not to be the case. So the serious attention needs to be paid to, again, what are called prebiotic foods, and these are foods that are naturally going to enable the body to produce the good bacteria. And there's a list, if you'll just look on the internet, of prebiotic foods. And, of course, a lot of these are just the natural veggies and green foods, organic foods that are readily available in these health food stores. And, of course, the probiotics. And so these are bacteria that are grown in the lab. And, again, the ones that I certainly think are the best are the ones that are by Dr. O'Hara, O-H-H-I-R-A. And that particular approach is one that, again, they actually are able to apparently grow these bacteria over a period of 5 years. Most of the probiotics don't do that. They sort of put them in a little, I guess, laboratory cell dish or petri dish or whatever, and then they allow them to grow for, you know, maybe a week or two, and then bingo, there you go. Well, the Dr. O'Hara's are very different from that. So I'm now checking into the chat room to see if we've got anybody who's typed in, here's what's up for me, here's what I want you to discuss, or all of us to discuss. And I don't see anybody there that's actually had an opportunity to type in anything. So if you're connected in, whether you're with your computer or not, remember there's the chat room. There's also the Q&A field as well. And you're most welcome and invited to write anything there so that we can respond accordingly. And what I wanted to do is to open up the lines to those of you who've called in here on your phone. And again, if you happen to have checked in to our support group gathering on your computer or on your phone and you haven't called in, you can call in and we'll be able to have an actual live discussion and, you know, connect and find out what's up and any reports about what's really been beneficial or what's been really helping you. So first of all, let me connect in here with Bill. Hello, Bill. How are you?
Hey, Robert. How are you?
Doing pretty well, thank you. So, my goodness, what's up with you out there in California?
Everything's good. I agree with you about the antibiotic situation. What a lot of people don't realize is you take one of these broad-spectrum antibiotics, and it's basically killing everything. It's killing good with the bad.
Right.
And so, you know, it kind of lays waste to everything. And so everything has to be built up from scratch. So it seemed to me people should be a little more hesitant, not just Parkinson's people, but anybody should be careful of just taking their doctor's suggestion, oh, we'll give you an antibiotic and maybe that'll clear whatever your complaint is.
Yeah.
You can see cautiously there.
Yeah, that's really, really sound advice, it seems to me. And, of course, there's a fine line. So if the infection has gotten so aggressive and so extreme, it may be that the informed choice really is to do the antibiotics. And the other hand, I do have friends who will say, yeah, I know I've got an infection, but I'm just going to gut it out, so to speak. And so they kind of just lie in bed for a week or 2 weeks. You know, they don't do much. They drink a lot of water and just let the infection run its course. And then their idea is that, well, my immune system's certainly going to be strengthened from that. So I know there are other approaches to when you get infections other than just antibiotics. So it's really a fine line with trying to figure out, okay, is this life-threatening, you know? Or, of course, the other really incentive to do the antibiotics is I think most of us have probably had that experience, and so we know we're really sick, we really feel awful. You start taking antibiotics, and boy, it seems like about, what is it, though, 2 or 3 days later, it's all of a sudden, whoa, I kind of feel normal again, you know? It's like, whoa,
yeah.
Not that I'm well, but I feel a lot better. So it's like such an inducive to feel like, okay, I really can't function very well. And of course, for some people, they've got demanding jobs and they've got to get back to work. And so they feel like, well, the best choice is so I can really feel better quickly. But again, the consequence is in the long run, my goodness, in the long run, it may be there's some pretty serious consequences. And as I said, the amazing discovery here that I have never seen before is they're talking about having these antibiotics 15 years ago. It's like, whoa. I had never thought that it would be that long-standing because usually you would think that good bacteria would eventually re-enter into the body, but apparently for people who are suffering with these neurological challenges, that, according to this study, is not the case necessarily.
Yeah, I did see that study you referred to. I forget how I ran across it, but that was pretty interesting, and in, like you said, the duration of the damage was considerably more than you might expect. I think people thought previously, well, in a month or two, the good bacteria would come back and you'd be back to the normal precondition, but apparently that's not the case. The damage
apparently, exactly, apparently not. And so that's the surprise. It's like, whoa. People really, even if they had antibiotics a long time ago, and even if they are doing probiotics, they need to really get serious about continuing with that and realize it's going to take the body a while. And, of course, I think the other signal for me, the alert is, if a person does have digestive challenges, well, there it is. That's where the focus of attention needs to be.
Right. I couldn't agree more. So I think it's, even if the connection to Parkinson's is not direct, I think anything you can get your general health, your digestive health, your lung health, whatever it may be, improved can only help you fight off Parkinson's and do what you need to do to deal with that as a separate issue. But, I mean, it's all one body, so any improvement you can make periphery, you know, can only be good. At least that's the way I look at it.
It's the way I look at it, too. I love your quote. It's all one body. I mean, we don't have two bodies. You know, we only have one. And
one that doesn't.
Yeah. Well, and it really is a miracle. I mean, we keep going from day in and day out. I mean, how in the world does that happen? I don't think any scientist has ever been able to figure out, how does this really happen? It's really a miracle for anybody who's a living entity, whether it's animal or human. So in the end, of course, the curiosity is, I think, that a lot of people who confront these neurological challenges, they really are looking for the most direct antecedent to the problem. And so that, of course, may be dopamine, and so they're getting an infusion of dopamine. But in the end, for healing from the inside out, what you really want to begin to ask is, all right, okay, so I've taken some dopamine supplements with L-DOPA to facilitate my dopamine supply, and it's made me feel better, which means dopamine is an issue. The next question, however, is, well, what's causing that? Hello? You know, why is it that the body is not naturally producing the dopamine that the person is need? So if you begin to really, and this is my thought, you know, speaking as a researcher, there are these long causal chains where you begin to back it up and you realize, whoa, wait a minute, if we go back far enough, finally, if we start at the right place, we'll really be able to bring the body back into full balance and harmony. And so, in a way, as you just described, well, the digestive system may not be the direct influence, but boy, it may be the one that we really need to work on first.
Right. Because that's, to me, one of the most vexing things about Parkinson's is that it's bad enough they don't have a cure for it or even begin to know how to cure it, but they also don't know what causes it. And those are two separate issues, so it's kind of hard to make progress where you don't know where it comes from and you don't know what to do about it when it does come.
Oh, I think that's right. And from my research, I think the reason why you don't see any clear definition of what the cause is that there are many of them. There are a lot of them out there. So it's such a multifaceted kind of a challenge is that, as it turns out, everybody kind of, it seems to me from the research I've done, has a different set of causes, a different set of factors that are influencing the problem.
Yeah.
And so, wow, it's really a complex, complicated kind of a thing.
Right.
And, of course, all of that then influences these really very delicate neural pathways. I mean, you know, if you look physically at what the texture of these pathways, boy, these are really delicate. So that if a person has a lot of trauma in their life, well, guess what? I mean, the kind of tissue that's most likely to be affected is going to be these very delicate, juicy, tender, electrical pathways. You know, that's going to just disturb the natural flow of what needs to happen through those pathways.
Right. Yeah, no, it's certainly 100, 200 years from now, as they get closer to understanding what's going on, I think it'll be a very complex set of relationships and issues that come together to create what we now call Parkinson's. But it's not just going to be one thing.
That's my very strong feeling too, Bill. I really think that's right. So when you sort of come out, and of course the words that oftentimes are spoken is, well, we need to have a cure, we need to have a cure. Well, wait a minute, so what's causing this? You know, you're not going to be able to address the problem unless you know what the cause is, and because the cause is so multifaceted and so complex, well, that's never going to happen. It's just a question of what the combination of factors are, and then what is it that's going to have to happen to address all those combination of causes.
Right. Well, that's why I think you do such a good service for people in laying out anything that has any possibility of being a factor in all of this and letting people decide for themselves if they want to buy into that or partially buy in or try it on a trial basis or, you know, rather than just say, do this and this will fix you, which, of course, it won't. So...
Right, exactly.
And
which is really, That's so true. And I always get so suspicious of these promotions where they say, well, you do this and you're going to get better. You know, you're going to get well. And I think, wait a minute. That may be true for some people, but it's not going to be true for everyone. So it's really what I think is the best thing to do is to just lay out all the different factors we know are causing the problem. And then what you want to do is once you know what it is that's at play, then you can then look at all these many, many different therapies that address those. And there are great therapies out there. The question is which ones are going to be the ones that will help you the most.
Right. So people just need to keep an open mind and be an experiment, you know, make themselves an experiment to see what works.
Right. Everybody becomes their own researcher, and they have a sample of one, and that sample happens to be themselves, their own body.
Yeah, exactly. And it takes some work and some effort and some, you know, most of it isn't going to work. I mean, the percentage is small of the stuff that works, but it's better than nothing.
That's right. No, and if you find the right combination of things, boy, some people are just so pleased with the result. It does take, of course, in a lot of cases, people have to devote some extra time in their lives to do the kind of things that are necessary to sort of tame down that sympathetic nervous system and support the parasympathetic. So it may be that there are some lifestyle changes that are really also indicated, which is really very difficult for a lot of people. But I really do believe, you've probably heard me say this before, Bill, but I really think that a big factor in whether or not a person is going to get well is the choice of taking charge of their recovery program, where all of a sudden they step back and say, well, I'm going to have to figure this out for myself, instead of trying to figure that there's somebody out there that's going to be able to solve it for them. So being able to be fully in charge of whatever decisions you're making, tracking the consequence of those decisions, that's huge, because when you're in charge, you're really in control, and nobody else out there is telling you what to do. They're not traumatizing you. You're the one who is able to monitor the choices that you make. And, of course, that, I think, in turn creates less anxiety, less concern, less stress, because instead of being worried about, you know, what somebody has told you that doesn't call out to your intuition, you really are making all of your decisions based on your best gut instinct about what's right for you, and you can't get better than that.
Right, and you really have to do that. If you give up control to anybody else, I don't care if it's a doctor or a loved one who has supposedly your best interest at heart, I mean, I think that's a mistake. You have to take that responsibility 100% on yourself.
I really believe that's true. And, of course, we know that one of the factors that influence these neurological challenges is trauma. There's just a lot of research that indicates that really mucks up the neural system. And so the problem with trauma is we're not in control. Somebody else is blasting into us in one way or another.
Yeah.
So we're able, if we're not in control, and allow somebody else to tell us what to do, then we are being re-traumatized. We are supporting that previous traumas that we might have experienced, and that's the last thing that we want to do. So being
that's
in control, as I see it, that's really huge. It really is.
Yeah, I agree. But thank you, Robert, as always, for your generosity and laying this huge panoply of ideas and suggestions and concepts, and I think that can do nothing but expand people's horizons and get them thinking about what they want to do about their situation.
It's an honor and a privilege, Bill, to be able to provide that support for people who are currently experiencing these symptoms. Thank you so much for those kind words.
Well, thank you.
And let me now connect in to Vonna. Hello, Vonna. How are you?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Yes, you're a little faint, but we can hear you.
Yeah. I have had a history in the past of trying to avoid antibiotics big time. But when I lived in San Antonio, I had a urinary tract infection, so the doctor put me on antibiotics. And I had it off and on. And then I moved to New Jersey, and being a conscientious person to establish myself with a doctor, I went and I said, now I've been known to have urinary tract infections. Do I have one? Oh, yes, you do. So I had no symptoms whatsoever, no burning, no nothing.
Ooh.
And so the doctor did a very, very good job of helping me manage my urinary tract infection. Not get rid of it, but just manage it, which is not complimentary in my mind. So I went through a lot of them, and I've tried to work to see how to avoid them. One is to get on some kind of hormones and various other ways, like drinking cranberry juice. And
I was going to say, that's the one I've heard. Has that been useful? Has that helped?
No, not really.
Oh.
Burned up a bottle of $21 bottle of cranberry juice. And then another is to, I've been told to wear cotton underwear and not silk underwear. That doesn't make a difference either.
Hmm.
So, and then I've also been taking different things off and on. It's either probiotic or prebiotic or poo-poo biotic or whatever. To get my system up. But I was a special ed teacher and supervisor in a public school, and I came across the teachings of a doctor named Dr. Crook. I know he doesn't sound very honest, but he's a doctor. And he's written books about how kids that have antibiotics and have them a lot and take a lot of antibiotics can get a systemic involvement with it. The lack of antibiotics, which, by the way, drives the infection back in the tissues. For instance, my children would have ear infection, and I would religiously give them antibiotics to the very last drop if it's a liquid thing. The doctor said, now be sure you take every bit of this. Well, what I understand happens is the antibiotics drive the infection back into the tissues.
Right.
So, and then after you've been free of an ear infection, after taking antibiotics, it might pop up a month or two later because it was the infection was driven into the tissues.
Yep. That's
did you know that?
Yes, yes.
So,
and I used to have a very different idea about the antibiotics because I did the same with my kids, and my idea is, okay, we have to take enough of this to kill all of the bad bacteria. That was my idea. So they say, okay, we're going to have 6 weeks of this. You go back, and the doctor says, well, I think you need another 6 weeks. And so my idea was, okay, that's all right, because we want to make sure that we kill them all. But instead, that's not what's happening. What's happening
is... You were killing the good and the bad bacteria.
That's exactly right. And then so some of the weaker bacteria, they can't fend off of the onslaught. But then there's a lot of, these are living entities. And so a lot of the ones that are more vibrant, they say, let's go hide out for right now.
until
it's clear, the coast is clear. So all of a sudden, okay, fine, we're good to go. And then they come out, and of course they create more problems and multiply. So,
in the literature I've read, you can have involvement many, many years later simply because you took a lot of antibiotics many years later.
And that's, of course, what the study indicates, too. Yeah, 15 years. My goodness, 15 years that you would have taken antibiotics, and then you're suffering the consequences even today. So pretty serious stuff.
What Dr. Crook also did is studied children who had taken a lot of antibiotics. The infection had become so systemic that the children became hyperactive. In other words, they were behavior problems. And they had all kinds of behavior problems. hyperactivity, et cetera. And that was due to taking antibiotics because it was systemic.
My goodness.
Now, I have a relative who had hip problems. He weighed about 300 pounds. And somewhere along the way, he had a problem with his hip. So he had hip surgery. But when they opened him up, they found out that in his hip was an infection. Excuse me just a minute.
We are just waiting for Vonna to come back to the phone. I think she had a little interruption, so we're just on pause.
Everybody. I did have an infection. So what did I say?
We're into the hip, and apparently they opened him up and they found an infection there?
Yes. So they closed him back up, and they couldn't do surgery until he got over this infection. So he had to be on antibiotics intravenously for 6 weeks or more.
Wow.
So then he had knee surgery most recently. And guess what? An infection popped up in his knee.
He had an infection, right? They didn't exactly get it, did they?
No, they didn't. And so the MD is not going to do much except he went back to the town where he had the surgery, opened up his knee and cleaned it out, and it was fine. And now, 4 to 6 weeks later, he's got the infection back in his kneecap.
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness. That's really serious. And, of course, I would think, given the location of the infection, it's hard for the bloodstream to get access to it. So,
yeah.
What a terrible challenge for that man.
Hold on just 1 second. Just 1 second. Somebody came to the door. My husband will get it. Are you there?
Yep, we're here.
So I was going to ask another question about different things. Let's see. So as far as taking responsibility, I am taking some lessons from this group that has some different exercises and things that you can do to help, would you believe, they said, reverse osteoporosis. So if anybody wants to know about it, they need to give me a call or call my or go on my email address. But I go to this lesson each one time a week for about an hour.
Oh. So give your email. Give your email right now so people who
Vonna,
have those issues can connect with you.
Vonna, it's V-A-U-N-A, Vonna 1@AOL.com. Like Vonna,
and it's the number one. It's the number one, the not the word one.
Yeah, V as in vodka, which I don't drink. Vonna. V-A-U-N-A, Vonna1@AOL.com. So, what have been the side effects of the esters? How has that helped people with PD?
When you say esters, are you referring to the ketone esters?
Yeah.
I have not heard of any side effects at all, Vonna.
I don't mean side effects. What are the benefits?
Oh. So what, for everybody who's here connecting in and listening, what Vonna has just asked about is actually a very new development in the laboratory where we are now able in the laboratory to produce a ketone ester. And this has not been possible before. The body runs on two types of fuel. The first fuel winds up being glucose. So when we eat carbs that are converted to glucose, the protein, like in meat, that's also converted to glucose. And, of course, as we all know, eating sweets or sugars, that's converted to glucose. So that can drive the fuel that is used by the brain and the body to function. Now, the other fuel is known as ketones, K-E-T-O-N-E-S, and that's something that the body manufactures naturally in the liver. So there are two sources of fuel. One of them turns out to be glucose, and the other turns out to be ketones. So why is it that taking a ketone ester or relying on ketones would be preferable for a person to glucose? And the answer is that it's a more efficient fuel for the body. So ketones, as it turns out, are long-lasting. They're natural. They're not, if you think of what glucose is, just listen to the word glucose, it's pretty sticky stuff. And, of course, if that's then used to fuel the brain, well, you're going to have a lot of protein coagulations that are unwanted. But if the body is being fueled by ketones, then that's not the case. The ketones are not anything like a sticky substance. So what's happened is that there's now the availability of the ketone ester that can actually be acquired and purchased. And what has been reported back to me is that the people who have used that find that, yes, they do get relief from their symptoms. And so they do also use that in combination with a very careful diet. So if they take the ester, for example, in the morning and they immediately then eat a breakfast with high carbs, that's going to undermine the effect of the ketone ester because the body is then being run on glucose rather than on ketones. So you really have to combine a dietary approach, and that involves usually fasting overnight. So when you fast, the body is producing ketones from the liver and pulling fat from the fat that's found in the tissues of the body to be able to produce the ketones. So many of you, I'm sure, have heard of a ketone diet. That's known as a high-fat diet. Not many people can stick to that approach for the long run. But when you have a high-fat diet, what you're doing is you are encouraging the body to be fueled by ketones because the liver uses the fat to produce ketones. So in the end, the ester, I think, is a groundbreaking and a revolutionary discovery, particularly for people who experience Parkinson's symptoms. So the two people that I've got a lot of information from who've used it over the long run will basically say that if they have a challenge with a task, perhaps it's at work, perhaps it's a social event where they don't want to have problems with symptoms, they do the ester, and apparently it provides them with relief that's somewhat comparable to what you get when you are taking medications.
I'm still on the conference call.
Say again?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I didn't have it muted. I'm sorry. I just told my husband I'm still on the call with you.
Oh, okay. So in the end, I think the ester is a wonderful research discovery and would recommend that anybody who's having a challenge with getting as much effectiveness from taking medicines, if you've chosen to take medicines, as you did before. I think the ester is something, and when you learn more about how the body functions and what the ester can do, I think that's something that you could use in conjunction with the medicines and talk with your doctor about how that might lengthen the on times for you. The other thing I want to mention...
I want to mention something before you let me go. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the other thing that I've heard, I talked to the man who's manufacturing this in his laboratory in Washington, D.C., which is they're connected to the researcher at NIH who's developed all of this technology. And I said, so what's up with people with Parkinson's? And he said, well, there's one thing people ought to know, and that is that he would recommend that you use the ester before going to sleep. And so men, he would recommend, would take about 5 drops, and women could take milliliters, not drops. Women can take less. And he said that the reports back are that it really does facilitate that deep REM sleep that's necessary for healing at the cellular level. So in the end, the one kind of a benefit is for people who want to explore that, I think that certainly at a minimum it would be a good idea to experiment with taking it before you go to sleep to see if you're not able to drop down into that deep states of sleep that are necessary for healing. So it's a wonderful discovery. I can't say more positive things about it, really.
Yeah. Okay. I've been working with, for quite a few years, this herb company, and they have tinctures. And one of drug tinctures that they have is skunk cabbage. And I have this lady that comes and does bowing work for me in my house.
Yeah.
And I ask her to put this skunk cabbage on my head, like massage it in my hair. It's very relaxing. It's very good for tremors, apparently. And so I feel very relaxed and have a good night's sleep. So if anybody wants to know where to get it from this herb company, they need to give me a call at 609-533-1116. That's 609-533-1116. There's another thing that I do. I put this retainer in my mouth at night to keep from snoring. I had a mild case of mild obstructive sleep apnea. And so I elected to have, instead of a CPAP machine, I elected to have just this retainer put in. So this stuff from this herb company is called SI, which stands for sinuses. And what it basically does is it helps to get rid of the layers of old crusty stuff that's in your sinuses. It's been there for ages. And I've tried that, and I've gotten a good night's sleep, because what happens when I don't use it is I start hacking and coughing phlegm from the back of my throat and my sinuses to the point to where I can't go to sleep. And when I do go to sleep, sometimes I have to wake up during the night to clear my throat again. And I can't clear my throat with that apparatus in my mouth. I have to get up and do all this garbage. So what I'm telling you, this herb SI helps get rid of the buildup in your sinuses. That's one thing I want to tell you.
It's called S as in Sam, I as in interest?
Yes, but it's from this herb company, and I'll tell you about the herb company. If you call me, I'll tell you about it.
Cool.
And it's been around for 30 years, and they have all tinctures. In fact, sometime at night when I lay down and my heart's about to palpitate out of my chest, I have a tincture that I take about 5 drops of one and 5 drops of another, and it helps to calm down my heart. And a lady told me about this company was a nurse, and where she used to work, the doctors and nurses would order tinctures from her because they knew that that would keep them out of the hospital.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. In other words, they don't have any side effects.
Right.
And you can take them. So there's that. And then the other thing I wanted to ask you about, what do you think of stem cell?
You mean stem cell treatments?
Yeah.
Well, so the research I've done would indicate that not all people, but many people do find that the treatments are beneficial. But I want to stress, not everybody by any means. So
yeah.
The good news is that it can provide some relatively temporary relief, but I want to stress the word temporary. So for the people that I've been able... say again?
I understand it's very expensive.
Yeah, I was about to get to that. So... the benefit is that it can provide some temporary relief, but the difficulty is that, first of all, the treatments can be very, very, very expensive. I mean, they can break your bank account for sure. And second of all, it's not long-lasting, so it's not something that you can get and expect that 5 years from now you're going to have the relief that you expected after, you know, a couple of weeks of getting the treatment. So it can be very beneficial, there's no doubt about it. And for some people that are really seriously ill, it may be very much a recommended strategy. I think the one thing I do want to say in terms of my own orientation is that that's an external intervention. The body knows how to make its own stem cells.
Uh-huh.
It's not as if the body can't do that. The body does. That's what the body's designed to do. It's not as if we've got a limited supply of stem cells. So I think in terms of an approach, the real cost to getting stem cells is that you are making a decision to somehow get fixed by some external intervention. You know, there's going to be somebody who's going to come in and say, okay, I'm going to fix you. Well, okay, again, that might be strongly recommended for people, especially who are seriously ill. But in the end, there are so many other therapies out there that are very cost-effective. Some of them, there's no risk to them at all. And they do allow the body to produce these cells naturally. And so in the end, I think if a person feels like they've got enough time to be able to nurture their body back to health and wellness, that there are other options that are less costly. So in the end, it's an option. I'm glad it's there. It does help some people. But I would say, as a footnote, I know there are some people that have said, yeah, I did that, and it didn't help at all. So we know it doesn't help everybody. But that's true for all people.
I read in a ARF magazine about a less invasive treatment for tremors. Did anybody see that?
I don't see that anybody has responded. So what's the source?
It's in an ARP.
Oh, an ARP. And what was their recommendation?
Talks about a less invasive treatment for tremors, and they have a name for it. They don't have a website for information for it. EX, this is how they spell it. The treatment is called EXABIATE. And the second word is neuro, NEURO. It destroys misfiring brain cells in the targeted area without requiring opening the skull. Like right now, doctors are opening up the skull and putting all kinds of things.
Oh, well, that sounds like that's a prescription medicine.
I don't know. It sounds, I'm not sure. You're going to have to excuse me. I've got to go. But
well, thank you so much for being here, Vonna. It's wonderful to get all of your wonderful suggestions. People have your contact information. So if you have
any
of the issues that Vonna's discussed, she's a great resource.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for being here today. We look forward to connecting with you next month, if not earlier. And so let me look to see if we've got anybody in our chat room, and we don't have anybody who's typed in some comments there for us to be able to address. And I'm looking at our call list, and I don't see anybody else who's called in. So it looks like we are at about the hour here, and so I think we're at the closure of our November 2019 Parkinson's Recovery Support Group gathering. Remember that you got access to our membership websites. There are 12 websites. I just yesterday posted all the entries for this coming week's websites. We've got wonderful meditations. We've got really funny jokes. We've got a Thanksgiving set of mind work for you to work on and lots of other wonderful experiences. So my invitation to you, again, is please connect in there at least for a few minutes every day, especially if you're at the point where you're a bit down, a bit depressed or discouraged about the prospects for your recovery. Well, get in there to the membership. Remember, the reason we do this, the reason we have this support group and provide all these other support services is to remind everybody on a day-to-day basis that there are lots of possibilities for healing. There are lots of options that are helping people to be able to reclaim their full life force. And so just a question of being able to realize that what is true is that more and more people are finding ways to be able to heal whatever neurological conditions they currently experience. Well, we look forward to connecting with you next month in December, which will be the last Monday of the month at 12 noon Pacific time. And that's what's happening here on the shores of the, and you know it, Puget Sound, where all the women are smart, all the men are handsome, and all of the children are profoundly loved. Know that by virtue of the fact that you are connected in here for a Parkinson's recovery membership, that you are joining our support group gatherings, that you are connecting into our websites, that you are listening to our radio show interviews on Parkinson's Recovery Radio, that in your own time, in your own pace, in your own fashion, using your own gut instincts and best decision making, that you indeed are traveling down the road to recovery in your own time, at your own pace, and in your own way. We look forward to connecting with you next month.